This is Dave Saunders.
And this is Courtney Engel.
And you're listening to Market Flow.
Visit us on the web at yourmarketflow.com.
How's it going today? Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. It is a Monday. Happy will come after the coffee, I
Are
believe.
you in Australia or something?
No, not today. Why?
Just seems like there's like kind of like the satellite delay going on here. I don't know. Maybe it's
Interesting.
just one of those things. All
I think it is.
right, well, let's kick it off. What's going on today?
Today, well, in scanning through the news, there seems to be quite a good bit coming into my inbox on a Monday morning. First thing I noticed was lots of news about that Twitter spam problem that was going on over the weekend. Do you get any direct messages involving lots of offers to buy all sorts of interesting products?
You know, amazingly enough, I was just looking because I had announced one of the Twitter phishing things going on, and it got retweeted a bunch, and I figured that would probably end up like painting a target on my forehead. And I just looked at my direct messages box, and the only thing I have is a bunch of messages between me and a customer service guy at Cox Cable trying to figure out why my cable modem wasn't responding correctly. By the way, good shout out to Cox Cable. I think there's a different cable company out there that does a couple social media things a little bit better, but hey, at least they responded, so that's a pretty happy thing.
Is good. So you have
But I didn't
absolutely
see any of the spam. No spam.
wow. So in doing so, are you using any kind of tools to protect your account to keep it free of any spam?
Nope.
Okay. I actually
Should I
use
admit that? Yeah.
well okay, go sign up right away for this site. There's a website called Social2. It's created by Jesse Stay. Really great site to keep your account clean. So the concept is a lot of people have their products that they're trying to sell right now, and some of them are highly illicit, illegal even, and the way in which they're trying to sell them. So what's happening is they're flooding lots of inboxes, and sometimes they'll even do it rather than click here to buy whatever the product is. They'll ask a question like, "Hey, is this you?" And they'll post a link that's supposed to be maybe
Oh,
some photo of you. Similar things have happened in Facebook, but at least with Twitter, it's hard to do in Facebook to actually control blocking that. Once somebody clicks on it just automatically announces to everyone that they're connected to lots and lots of spam. But in Twitter, there are a couple of tools that you can get in place to help protect an account from that. Now, the thing about them is they don't necessarily filter the difference between true spam and someone that just automatically sends a welcome direct message. So a great site to check out for that is Social2, as in TOO, social2.com. And Jesse put that site together, and having that hooked up on my account, I've cut down on a lot of that spam coming into my own account, and I automatically set it up for any new accounts that I work through and create and things. And the free version of it's got a lot of good features just to block a lot of that. So now that you've announced that you're not using it, I would say go sign up instantly.
Well, I think I have a Social 2 account because didn't they start out like doing like auto follows and they would do auto DMs? I mean, didn't they actually create some of these problems by in the very, very beginning?
Actually, Social2 was always opposed, from what I can remember, always opposed to the auto DMs. I think it was what's now Social Oomph, which used to Twitter or
Tweet
tweet.
later.
Tweet, yeah, tweet later. Yeah, tweet later used to do those auto welcome messages, but Social2 has been pretty opposed to it staunchly the entire time. And they actually will start flagging accounts, at least within their own system, and I believe they might send it on to twitter.com for anyone that is sending those kinds of auto welcome messages. So that's a great way to protect that account. But really, the idea here is use your judgment when you're seeing any kind of message that's like, "Hey, is this you? Is this a picture of you? Or do you want to buy this thing?" Especially if it's in your direct message box, don't click on it. It looks pokey.
Yeah,
Just
you know,
don't.
there are some forms of communication that I consider to be like just so useless that I ignore them almost completely. And among those, Twitter direct messages. In TweetDeck, I have the column turned off, And the only reason I turned it on was because I made a shout out through the Twitterverse to Cox Cable to come help me. And then I knew they were going to DM me, so I added the DM column to TweetDeck to monitor them responding back to me, and then I'll go and delete it again. And then the other one, of course, is Facebook email, which I consider to be the most useless thing in the universe. And I think I finally have crossed 2,000 unread messages for my Facebook inbox. And I just don't. There are no tools for going through to deleting it. The delete function is as far as I'm concerned, completely useless. You know, if I click on a message and then click the delete button, those two mouse button sequences should be more than sufficient to confirm the fact that I want to delete the message. I don't need a third button to show somebody's incredible Ajax prowess to ask me if I really wanted to delete the message. And I'm certainly not going to do it 2,000 times. It might come up as an Elance job, though. So, anybody out there, you might want to just put up a monitor for those kinds of jobs on Elance, and maybe I'll hire you to go in and delete all my mail, or maybe not. I don't know. I don't think I'm going to get it. Maybe nobody's going to have access to that.
There is at least
Yeah,
a
we'll just skip that. Yeah, just going to.
there is at least a
I think I'm going to
select
have a
all.
party. Yeah, but it only selects all that's on the screen, which
Yeah.
is another useless concept of select all. Yeah, my dictionary might be a few years out of date. I mean, I still have like a nice big paper dictionary. I buy them, every couple of years just because I like them. And every once in a while, laptops don't boot and stuff, and I want to look something up. And I just the word all to me means all, completely inclusive, everything that's available. And so this goes for Google Mail too, that when I say select all, and then I want to delete something like from a search string, I don't just mean the only things that you bothered to show me in the current web view. I mean all. That's what the word means. I just don't, interface designers need to like have a copy of the dictionary to make sure that their buttons actually match the English language. Because, yeah, Facebook does that. Yeah, select all. Great. So 10 messages out of 2,000. Yeah, that's not really all that helpful either. But at some point, I'm going to have a party. I think when I hit 10,000 unread messages in Facebook, then I'm going to have like a big party or something. And maybe as part of, the whole party scene, I'll have my laptop open, and everybody who comes to the party can delete 10 messages, and that'll make them all happy.
I'm not sure that I want to go to the
All
party,
right, I'll
but
shut up now.
yeah, I'm not coming to that
Yeah,
party. So here's a question for you
okay.
related to this, Dave. As far as clients and customers contacting you, do you ever experience them
Yeah.
contacting you through multiple places? For example, clients trying to reach you through Twitter, through Facebook. Are you filtering them down and saying, if you're a client and you need to reach me for business purposes, you must reach me through either my phone or my email? Or are they kind of bombarding you everywhere?
Well, I have sort of a weird situation there. I think it's all about training in one way. So if I never respond to Facebook and I never respond to Twitter direct messages, then I would assume that by some sort of Pavlovian miracle, they're going to kind of figure that out. But what I do experience is, I've got multiple domains. I've got actually a ton of domains. And for historical reasons, some domains I actually use for email, and they're on different lists and things like that. But I use Gmail. It took me a long time to get off of Outlook, which I loved for years. And of course, it took me a long time to start putting my PC on email because I used to use Elm years ago, and then I was sort of forced to move to a PC for my email. And so I used Outlook for years, and then I realized that when you've got like multi-gigabyte PST files in Outlook, launching the program creates this like 10, 20-minute delay where the hard drive just spins and spins and spins and spins. And I really love that. So I finally just moved everything over to Gmail. And of course, for a while, I had a BlackBerry, and the Gmail client on the BlackBerry is super crazy awesome. Gmail on the iPhone sucks, but of course, all email support on the iPhone is nearly dark ages as far as I'm concerned. I think the programmers that are doing the email client on the iPhone work by candlelight, because I don't think they're completely up to the fact that they are dealing with electrons and, computers and things like that. Do they have chisels for when they write the code? It's so back-ass. I did. Okay. Anyway. So, what I have happen is people will email me and they will send the email to every single email address that they've ever observed that I use, but it all goes to exactly the same inbox. And so here I end up getting like six copies of the exact same message from different people because they're sending it to six different addresses. And after it happens once or twice and I notice it, I'll kind of mention to them and I'll be like, well, this is how it works. It all comes to the same inbox. And I always get the same deer in the headlights response where they just, it's inconceivable to people that all of my email would go to the same inbox. Well, why would you do that? If they all go to the same inbox, then why do you have different email addresses? I'm like, because it's just the way it is.
Actually,
So
even in the days
yeah,
of
I had this.
Outlook, wasn't it all still coming into Outlook, even if you had multiple addresses?
Oh yeah, I mean this has been an ongoing problem for about 15 years actually. So
Right.
yeah, it's been a problem for a while.
Right. I actually
But
find.
oh well.
For me, it's that sometimes I will end up doing business or clients will come to me because of some of the social media channels, and they'll start exploring and learning more social media channels, and then they'll reach me as their primary place. They'll choose a different platform each week as to where to locate me for business purposes, where, I actually do go through my Facebook inbox at least occasionally because sometimes opportunities come in through that for me. And likewise, I do keep my direct messages open, and I actually use it as it's more intended to be. But at the same time, there's a time and a place to also move them away from some of these channels and say, here's how to reach my inbox. And I've actually started having some of the same things happening now with the phone world. So, with having a cell phone and a house phone and a voiceover phone and a this and a that, they'll try to reach me through any of these mechanisms. And yeah, I'll even occasionally text message with clients depending upon the circumstances and the situation. And so, to help get around that, just as you moved everything into Gmail, I have pulled everything over into Google Voice. Are you using Google Voice yet?
I have okay, so I have a I got on the Google Voice beta
Okay.
and I have a Google Voice phone number
Right.
and 5014 NEMOC, and that's pretty cool. And it just goes straight to voicemail, and I do like it. I think it's pretty cool. But what I really love about Google Voice, even though there are some really neat features when you actually use your Google Voice number, there's definitely some cool stuff there, but what I think is just so super awesome is letting Google Voice take over the voicemail on my iPhone.
Oh.
And so I don't, of course, I lose the iPhone ability to have the voicemail right there and click play and all that, but I don't really care. But instead, I've got all of my voicemail. It's I can get it, google.com/voice, and it's all in the inbox, and I got the transcript. Of course, the first thing I had to do was turn off the transcript to SMS feature, because that was driving me insane, because I would get voicemails where sometimes people go, it's like they're it's like I get phone calls from the Unabomber and he's like reciting the manifesto that he got printed in all those newspapers. And they want to do this through voicemail. And then, of course, the transcript feature just goes, so I end up getting like 20 text messages for one person's voicemail. So if anybody from Google Voice happens to be listening by some unbelievable miracle to this particular episode, I would like a feature where it just notifies me that I have a voicemail, but it doesn't send me a transcript. That would be cool. But I still want the transcript when I go to the inbox,
Right.
because I get the transcript in my inbox. It's in my email. So that's like just super awesome. And then I now run the web version of Google Voice through my iPhone, because apparently Apple decided that by their judgment, the universe doesn't need a native Google Voice app. This is going to be my complaint about Apple Day. But so it's cool. I mean, it works, it runs great, then I can play the voicemail message. So I just think it's so awesome, the feature for Google Voice to take over the voicemail from my phone. I've sent out I got three invites with Google Voice, and so I sent out the three other people, and that was the first thing they all did. They had the thing take over their voicemail, and all of them, that's the response. They're like, I love this feature.
Right. I haven't.
The only person who had a problem with it, she has two phones, and so she wanted to do Google Voice on her personal mobile phone, but she gets email on her work BlackBerry. She doesn't like getting the text messages with the transcripts because, it's obtrusive when you get four or five text messages with the transcript. And so, but then she doesn't know that she got voicemail necessarily if she missed the call, if she was underground in the metro or something. And so she doesn't know if there's a voicemail unless she goes over to the other phone to then see the email notification. So again, if there was just a text message notifying that you have a voicemail, that'd be really, really cool. But yeah, everybody I've shown it to, they're always like, this is the coolest thing. So I've been doing that. I haven't really played with the Google Voice number, but I know you do a lot more with that.
Right. I actually, instead of giving out my own cell phone number anymore or any of my other numbers to find me at, I just give people my Google Voice number, and you can create essentially lists or groupings of people. So you can say, all of the people, these specific contacts that I know get my voicemail greeting. If I'm not answering my phone, they get my voicemail greeting that I have for clients. These other people get the one that I have for my family and my friends, or however you want to organize it. You can also then make Google Voice forward to any phone number that you connect it to. So you can have Google Voice ring your iPhone or whatever it happens to be. Could be your house phone, it could be, a voice over line, whatever. You could direct Google Voice phone numbers and say, if I don't know the number, they hit my voicemail. If I don't even want to receive a call from them, I put them on my spam list, so telemarketers be gone. You can also do other kinds of fun things with the Google Voice number. For instance, if I want to call somebody and I want it to show my Google Voice phone number when I call them, then I can just go into either the website version, or I've got two versions of Google Voice on my iPhone, two different apps for that, one of which is just by browsing to voice.google.com through Safari. So you could get there and you could actually start the call, and it says, which phone number do you want to ring if you've got multiple phone numbers hooked up? And Google Voice then first dials whatever phone you're routing it to, and then it calls the person that you want. So Google Voice itself is not really your phone provider. In fact, this service is entirely free. They're not really going to be your phone provider, but what they will do is direct the traffic flow. So similar to collecting all your email into one Gmail place, Google Voice can do a lot of those functions. And they actually just posted something this week on the official Google blog about what the features are a little bit further about Google Voice. And I happen to be loving this service a lot. I think it's got a lot more capabilities and potential. And I hear that if you're using a Nexus One or an Android phone, that because it's a Google platform, that simply it's just fantastic. You can replace the phone number with this. So,
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
yeah.
so this is a win compared to Buzz.
Yes. Buzz, backlash still ensuing, and they've made modifications and changes, but it wasn't planned out well. And in this case, I believe that
Yeah.
the voice actually, there was a platform that they had bought, and I'm forgetting the name of it right now. But they pretty much acquired a platform and just modified it a bit and then released it as voice.
Yeah. Well, we talked about Buzz last time and
Yeah.
no real news there. So, all right,
Not
moving
yet.
on.
I
What do we
actually
got?
came across a website about dealing with compliance and issues that you have to clarify regarding websites anytime that you are advertising or using an affiliate link or testimonials, any of those related matters,
Oh,
called
yeah.
Comply.
This is a pretty cool site, cmp.ly, so more fun with URLs. And it's pretty cool because I'm okay with the need for disclosing, if you're going to send out an email to your mailing list and have people click on a link, I'm okay with disclosing the fact that it's an affiliate link. I'm kind of amazed that there are people out there that would, like, for example, be on, oh, John Rees's internet marketing mailing list and would not be completely clued into the fact that John is making money by sending email for somebody else on his mailing list. So, I mean, there are some times when, okay, I'm not a lawyer, but there are some times when it just seems like the reasonable person to me would think that it's completely and totally obvious that you're dealing with an affiliate link. But, I got to recognize that it's a brand new world and we've got, millions and millions of people being added to the internet, and we've got, baby boomers are just, swarming over the internet like locusts, and nothing wrong with that. And, so it is kind of a nice thing to take some of these what might seem obvious issues to some people. And it's not about, somebody, being stupid or anything like that. It's just, this is a brand new world and it's not obvious to everybody, and certainly a lot of newcomers who are coming in by the millions, that yeah, there might be an affiliate link there, and it might affect their purchase decision if they know if a person is going to make money on something or not, which is, I guess, part of the anti-capitalism New Deal that we now live under. I guess that's okay. The testimonials thing still confuses me though, because there was the whole FTC, the sky is falling, everybody was like screaming, oh my God, the entire universe is going to end on December 1st. And certainly from the lawyers that I spoke to, and I'm actually working on an interview with two partners from a law firm in DC that actually specialize in FTC law, and they're going to give me some interview material on this whole issue with the FTC and disclosure and testimonials. But there's this whole concept called typical results that just seems so stupid to me that, it's amazing. I mean, just I'm probably going to get death threats because I live so close to DC here, but I probably won't even get threats. They'll just kill me. It typifies the concept that only a bureaucrat that has obviously never actually tried to operate a business or tried to do any sort of sales on their own behalf, but just sit around sucking on the teat of the American public with their salary from tax dollars, would come up with the concept that typical results need to be the results that most people get from, say, a diet. I mean, it has nothing to do with, say, for example, Subway, as to whether or not a person's going to lose weight trying to do the same thing Jared did. Why? Because it's about human nature. Most people will find all kinds of internal excuses. They'll find all kinds of ways to justify the way they do things differently. Oh, I can't lose weight. My body type is just different. Okay, simple math. Take in fewer calories than what you burn, you're guaranteed to lose weight. It just doesn't work any other way. I'm sorry, I've been there. I've gone up and down, and it just blows me away that at least the way that the lawyers I spoke to interpreted that the FTC was doing away with the concept of allowing people to share success stories. And because that's exactly what's happening. If you say that the only testimonials that you can share are actually reflective of typical results, then every single real estate training program, heck, even if you want to treat somebody how to be a realtor and help them pass their realtor exams and all that, any diet program, any gym, every single one of these people need to come out completely and tell you, okay, here's the deal. You're going to pay us money and you're probably going to gain weight. You're going to lose money. You're going to lose your house. You're going to be poor. But at least you can say that you've got a new business card or whatever, you've got new workout shorts or these things, because typically people don't get results. It has nothing to do with the organization they're paying money to, and it has everything to do with them and their own personal excuses that they drag around like baggage on their back. And so the whole testimonial thing, I think, is completely messed up. And I think it's funny because I've been really paying attention to this online, and I've actually been told by law firms that they are recommending I think is the right word, to their clients that have come to them with concerns over this, and they're saying, just ignore it. They're like, this law or this rule from the FTC is so completely absurd that it'll never pass the muster test in court. Now, that's, of course, that's always sometimes considered to be a dare when it comes to them, the enforcers, at any of these organizations. But it does seem to be really interesting that some of the people that I saw online who said that they would never share another case study to teach other people, hey, here's how I do, like Jeff Walker in the product launch formula. I'm never going to do another case study because case studies are only about people who have success. And unfortunately, 90% of the people out there don't have success. Or it takes them 5 years instead of 1 year. It takes them 10 years instead of 1 year. Why? Because, I don't know, they had to have therapy, get hit by a bus or whatever, so that they would have the epiphany to go, oh, I just need to like get off my butt and do something. Okay. And it seems like these guys are completely ignoring these rules, and they're just going right back to using testimonials and case studies and things like that, which I think is great because it makes absolutely no sense to restrict those. And the whole loss of safe harbor by saying results not typical, that's the dumbest thing ever. I don't know about the Taco Bell diet, what's that called? The drive-through diet or something like that? I mean, there's kind of a funny example, although again, if you are eating less calories through Taco Bell than what you're burning, physiologically you should be losing weight. I don't know if that's the healthiest approach to weight loss, but hey, once in a while Taco Bell is awfully darn tasty. They don't sponsor us, so hey, there's full disclosure where I did not get any sort of sponsorship by saying Taco Bell is tasty, and oop, there I said it again. But yeah, I would check out Comply because I think it's pretty cool, and I think people do need an easy way of just saying, hey, here's the deal. I've got an affiliate link. I'm telling you about this product, and if you buy something, that's great, and if you do, I'll probably make a couple bucks.
So for
And
the
sadly, most affiliate marketers don't make very much money at all anyway.
so in
Sorry, what?
the process of using Comply, just so that we're clear, for the average person, average business owner to know what to do with that, there's some settings. You pick your degree of how much what you're it walks you through a set series of steps as to what you need to disclose, what you need to tell people that you're there doing on your website, though it should be somewhat obvious. Just for full disclosure, you walk through the series of questions and it says, here's the one that you need to tell people about. They do give you a graphic icon, but I think they also give you a link. Do you have any suggestions as to, for the average person that doesn't do a lot of web work themselves, where should they put this information when they're disclosing this? Just throw a link into their emails and in
Oh,
the footer, or what do you think? How obvious? Lead out with it?
I love there are different ways to do it, and it always depends on your own skill as a copywriter and things like that. I think somebody what's his name, Joe Vitale, who's he looks he's got the gold chains and stuff in the movie The Secret. He's an awesome writer. And I could imagine him actually leading into sales copy saying it's an affiliate link and actually increasing his results because of it. Most people, that's not a good way to lead things in because your sales copy really needs to say, this is what I got, this is what it'll do for you, and here's what to do next. Even if it's an affiliate link, it's the same process. Here's what this is, here's what it'll do for you, and here's what you should do next. Those you got to hit people with those things or they're gone. So in general, I would put those things, don't bury them, in tiny little links or way, at the end of your email or something like that. But yeah, put in something clear. And John Rees, actually, I just saw an email come out from him where it says, like, it's a link to something from Ryan Dees. And then there's like a big disclaimer. It's all in caps. And of course, interestingly enough, I think because it's all in caps, it's harder to read. And so therefore, most people won't read it. But it does say, disclaimer, this contains affiliate links. If you click on them and buy something, the publisher will be compensated. That's pretty straightforward. That's fine. I appreciate the honesty. So I would put it in there, probably at the end of the web page. You gotta focus on your own marketing efforts first, which means that you need to tell the other person what you got, what it'll do for them, and what to do next. That's always gotta be first, or your sales are just gonna go nowhere. and no amount of economic stimulus is ever going to help dig us out of that if the FTC continues to bury us in anti-capitalist regulations. Honesty, transparency, disclosure, all good things. Happy with that. Just not all that great with rule systems coming from people who couldn't run their own companies to save their lives. So yeah, comply is definitely good. It's real easy to use. I was just popping through it myself, and it's got very clear descriptions. In fact, there's a link at the top, how to disclose, and it lists the six different levels of disclosure that they've kind of created categories for. And I think there's a very, very, clear description of what each of those things mean. So hats off to these guys for creating a great solution for what could have been just one heck of a mess.
Yeah, good find. Very good find. So, a little bit of other news. Did you happen to watch any of the Olympics lately? Have you been tuning in?
I watched, and I'm not kidding, I watched curling.
Excellent. Did you see the guys with the crazy pants?
Curling gets a bad rap, but I just love it because these guys, I mean, if laser beams could come out of their eyes, I swear they would just like start melting the ice, because I have never seen, like, in the guys, I don't know any of the terminology for curling, even though I was watching it. And but the whatever the big the big kettle goes zipping along the ice, and then there's guys in front of it, and they've got their own little brushes, and they're swishing in front of it on the ice to adjust the friction or whatever. And the focus on their eyes is just incredible. It's so cool to just watch that energy. I've watched curling, but I've been like just crazy busy still digging out the snow from DC, and so I haven't watched a lot of the other stuff yet. I heard the hockey game was fun,
Oh,
and
yeah.
I probably watched a grand total of like 30 seconds of what I understand is time delayed skiing. And I actually think that all I have to do is like say Olympics on Twitter, and I can probably get a better running commentary of what's actually going on, which I guess is probably the point of why you're asking me, right?
It is. It is. In fact, watching last night, I was at a meeting for a little while when the first and second periods were going on for the Canada USA hockey game, which was amazing. But I was following the first two periods simply through Twitter because the crowd that I was with were we were having a little bit of a brainstorming meeting going on, but we really weren't able to watch the game at that time. It wasn't until I got to another friend's house and caught the end of the third, which was just amazing. But I was following it all through Twitter, and in the process, I have friends, I would say loose term friends, in Australia and in Canada and around the globe, really, and they're telling me that they're getting the information in real time. I'm only, what, 2, 3 hours different in the time zones, and I'm finding the frustration that NBC is just the way that they're handling certain aspects of it. I get that they've got some financial needs, but at the same time, I feel like the time delays and some of the scripting between, when they have the commentary information going on between, and even down to the things like what they're deciding to put on NBC that's, free to the public. Anyone without any subscriptions to TV can even get that, versus what's on maybe MSNBC. They put the hockey game on MSNBC and had ice dancing on regular NBC, and I think the public demand was actually higher for the hockey, but I don't know that they could just make the switch at the last second. And then there's even things like the thought of, can the IOC, the Olympics Committee, if you will, can they take on some of the broadcasting and just resell the rights into TV network space? Let the IOC be the one doing the broadcasting in real time. From what I hear from my friends in Canada, they're able to get all of this information through the web real time, whereas there's time delays in the US. And, aside from the late night TV wars of NBC and maybe other financial woes, I really think that NBC could do better than what we saw 2.5 years ago at the Summer Olympics. I think we could do better than
Here's my
obviously what
theory.
we've got now. Go
I've
ahead.
got a theory. Wardrobe malfunctions.
Right, because the hockey players might
That's what it's
lose
all
their
about. It's
gloves.
if it, the NBC is worried about getting sued by the FCC in the event of a wardrobe malfunction. Because, if you're a downhill, like a speed skier or something, and you're like zipping along and you like fall and they're wearing that, crazy tight spandex and there's nothing going underneath there. And so the friction from the snow is gonna like, rip off part of your clothes. And so then suddenly there you are with a wardrobe malfunction and the FCC, the moral police of the entire universe, comes down on their little golden horse with wings, and protects the universe from seeing somebody's buttocks with a giant fine. And so that's, I think that's the theory. I think NBC is just scared of wardrobe malfunctions. So,
You may be onto something. Well,
yeah.
yeah, I just
Yeah, could be.
I think that in general NBC is not getting my vote for the best job with Olympic coverage. I think there's a lot more interactive real-time web that can be done, and I've thoroughly enjoyed my conversations with friends across the globe during the Olympics. I was talking to another friend in Bangladesh, and he's telling me he was following some of it, but it's not so big in his country because, well, they don't have anyone competing. But at least they're able to follow it very well on the web from Bangladesh. So, interesting. Very
Yeah, that's a little
interesting.
weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're on the other side of the planet where there's definitely not a lot of snow going on and you're getting better coverage than we are, especially here in DC and you're in Pennsylvania where we've been buried in 3 feet of snow, I think we should have a slightly better connection to the whole Winter Olympic thing going on, but yeah, I guess not this year. Maybe 4 years from now. When it's confirmed that, well, see, 4 years from now we'll be past the whole 2012 panic, so that'll be okay.
Right.
And then I think the executives at NBC will be at least pretty much convinced that we are in fact in the 21st century at this point. And at that point, they'll stop wearing their wingtips and fedora hats. Or maybe they will start wearing wingtips and fedora hats. We'll have to ask Justin Timberlake, exactly what's necessary there, because he is in charge of bringing sexy back.
yeah.
And after we figure all that out, so maybe maybe 4 years from now we'll have a better Olympic coverage. I'm not going to hold my breath because, well, I can't hold my breath for 4 years, so I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, so are you reading any good books lately? Find anything else
I
interesting in the
just
past few weeks?
finished. Yeah, I just finished a book called The Experience. I think what was it? Last time I was talking about the attention economy, which is good. Or no, is that what I talked about? Yeah. And I've been reading this kind of like trifecta of books about some form of economy. And so I just finished The Experience Economy, and then hopefully for next week I'll finish reading The Support Economy. Yeah. I'm just really crazy that way. And the experience economy is just a really fascinating concept because it made me think about just in terms of like how we present products and things like that. And just one example, I blogged about this on my blog at davesaunders.net. And the idea there is, I was just thinking about, and there are examples in the book here, so it's not entirely my idea, but I was thinking about like how you compare like a theme park like Disney or SeaWorld or Universal Studios to kind of like one of those run-of-the-mill carnivals and fairs. And now carnivals and fairs are fun too, but it is kind of interesting that you pay this big boatload of money to go into Disney, and then you're there for the experience, and you may ride a whole bunch of rides. You may ride which mountain, and that's it. You may not ride any rides, and yet you're there having an experience. And contrast that to going to like a fair or a carnival where usually you go in for free, or maybe there's some nominal fee for entrance, but then you go and you buy tickets or somehow pay for every one of those rides individually. And I as I was writing the blog, I actually did like, IM a bunch of people and I asked them like kind of what their experience was. And without any exceptions, every single person said, yeah, when I go to one of those places where I've got like tickets for the individual rides, they're like they actually like think through what that ride is going to be like before they even get on it, and they're like already creating like this value critique based on the number of tickets they're going to have to spend. So they're completely hung up on the event or the thing or the product or the service, and they're completely ignoring the big experience that they would otherwise get to have. And that's what Disney is doing, where they're giving away the services, they're giving away the rides, and they're charging you for the experience. And what's cool is, I was even thinking like with my parents, which like, I remember, it was a pretty long time ago, but I remember when we went to Disney World when I was a kid, and my mom didn't get on a single ride. She's terrified of those things. And yet she paid the same boatload of money as all the rest of us. And I called her and I said, "Do you remember when we went to Disney World?" And she's like, "Oh yeah." And she just started describing like all of these things about Disney World. And it just blew me away that here's somebody who didn't ride any of the rides, paid a lot of money to go, and yet she had an experience as a result. And I just thought that was really cool. And so it's like, kind of one of the musings in my blog post was about just, okay, so if you took whatever it is that you do, you're a consultant, or you have products or services, or you sell nutrition, or whatever, maybe you can't do this necessarily, but it's just really interesting to think about. Just kind of, go and do like a little what if, sit back in your chair, drink some scotch, whatever it takes, and just think about, okay, what if I charged my customers admission instead of charging them for the end product? How would that change their experience of what's going on? How would that change how they perceive the value of what's going on? And how would it even change my own interaction with those customers? And it impacted me so much that I was just like, okay, in fact, I'm actually rewriting a couple sales letters for some of my webinar things, because I realized that I've always been kind of like skating right along that edge where, yeah, I'm actually bringing people in for the experience, because I know that not every single person who comes into my big webinar series, I've got like eight webinars, it's all crammed into 1 month, and we just like go through all this online marketing stuff, and I know that there are some things I pre-announce everything. And so I know there are some things that some of the people who sign up, they're like, "Eh, I don't need that particular class," or "I don't want that particular class," and that's okay. Because what I'm really having, or what I was really selling them, is the experience of coming in, having all that cohesive training, having everything, and then, months later, if you decide that you wanted that class, you can always come back and look at the archives anyway. You lose the benefit of being able to ask questions live and things like that, but you are coming in for the experience, and all those rides are just part of the total admission price. And so when that kind of all gelled in my head, I was just like, wow, that's so cool. And I think there's a lot of really cool opportunities online, and even there was a what if in the book where it was like, what if Sharper Image? They've got all those crazy toys, and last time I checked, they weren't doing too well financially. What if they changed their entire business model? I mean, it's like those products themselves, yeah, they're sold at premium prices, but they're made by the same overseas manufacturers as pretty much anything you buy at Walmart, I presume. And so what if Sharper Image instead charge some sort of admission to come in there, and you could take out, like you go in once, like you pay like a membership fee, and you can go in there once a month, and you can use all the products, and you can take something with you once a month, or whatever. I'm just, kind of throwing that out there. They didn't go into too much detail with that example. It was just kind of like a what if. But I mean, how would that change things? I mean, that would be kind of fun. I mean, I actually like to go into Sharper Image and Brookstone just to like kind of poke around and look at the stuff. And I admit that I don't buy a lot of their stuff, but I like to go around and poke at it. So what if they charged me for the experience and actually gave me stuff that I wanted to play with and to take it home? Could they actually come up with a financial model to make that work? Not so sure, but it's a fascinating concept just to think about that. And so, of course, anybody listening, you can always go back to yourmarketflow.com and leave us comments there if you've got some ideas for what your own business, or if you can think of somebody out there where it's like, hey, this would be really cool if like this business here did it, you know, loved it. Love to see what other people think in terms of ideas for how they would do that. So that's me, experience economy.
Very cool. Sounds like a great book. Well, I think that's about it for today. So I'll be signing off now, and we'll catch you guys again next week. Again, tune in at yourmarketflow.com. This is Courtney Engel.
And this is Dave Saunders.
Have a great week.
And you've been listening to Market Flow.